Part 10 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Scrutinies, Part 2.
It was generally known since the original German edition of Jung's and Annie Lajafe's Memories, Dreams and Reflections of C.G. Jung, which was published in 1962, only a year after Jung's death, that book contained in its appendix a large chapter entitled in Latin Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, which translates as the Seven Sermons to the Dead, that Jung had written in 1916, the full title of which was The Seven Sermons to the Dead, written by Basilides in Alexandria, the city where East and West meet. Now, there were some curious and in part even misleading statements made in the introduction to the text in that book. Mind you now, that was published after Jung's death. Among them, that the language of the Seven Sermons corresponds approximately to that of the Red Book. Also, the introduction created the impression that Jung characterized the Seven Sermons as a youthful indiscretion, quote, and that he repented of them. Most perplexing was a footnote appended to this introduction which said, Nur in der deutschen Ausgabe, only in the German edition. The first American edition, published by Pantheon Books in 1961, did not contain the Seven Sermons. A subsequent American edition published the Seven Sermons under the heading of Appendix 5. Commentaries on the sermons were slow in coming, and by the way, I'll interrupt myself with my permission and say that as one investigates the material in the Red Book and also in various other works, what Jung said was that not the writing or the content of the Seven Sermons was a youthful indiscretion, but that its publication at that time, in 1916, might pass, as he jocularly said, as a youthful indiscretion. And it's of that particular early publication date that he somewhat repented. So commentaries on the Seven Sermons were slow in appearing. In fact, as far as I'm aware, there were only three journal articles, two in the Journal of Analytical Psychology and one in the Spring Annual until 1982, when my own exegetical effort entitled The Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons to the Dead, published in 1982, saw the light of day. Subsequent references, such as made by Robert Siegel in his dishonestly entitled The Gnostic Jung, dishonestly because it stole my title, I found out was something that I didn't know prior to that time, that titles are not copyrighted. But that's all right. So the dishonestly entitled Gnostic Jung, that hardly qualifies as an exegetical work because it really does not engage in any interpretation of the Seven Sermons or anything else. All along, it needs to be remembered that Jung, sometime between 1916 and 1925, probably around 1920, published privately, without indication of time and place, a small book, printed very artistically, of the Seven Sermons. This book he distributed privately to a number of colleagues and friends. And this was the early publication which he may have felt that would have probably been better not to have occurred at that particular time. In fact, the greatest likelihood is that if he repented of that publication at all, the cause of it was the formidable and extremely Jehovah-like and noisy Martin Buber, who had come across that publication from someone to whom a copy was sent, and who then gravely accused Jung of being a Gnostic. Now, it's really a very, very bad name then and now, if you are thus disposed. And it was such a privately printed copy which I encountered in 1949 and subsequently translated and then published with extensive commentaries in my book, The Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons to the Dead. The story of my discovery of that text is recounted there in the prologue of the book. May I also add that subsequently, after my book appeared in a German translation, I received a gift from Jung's son, the late Franz Jung, an original copy of Jung's privately printed book, which I have and I treasure. The late Franz Jung accompanied the gift with a handwritten letter in which he thanked me for having represented his father's ideas with great accuracy. I have both of these, and if you are very, very good and promise to come back and, you know, various other things, put large amounts of money into that basket over there, if you're very, very good, I might bring that book and the letter down with me next time and we'll exhibit it here on a kind of a no-touch basis. So such then are my own connections with the Septem Sermones Ad Mortuos, the Seven Sermons to the Dead. My interest in this scripture was motivated both by a high regard for C.G. Jung and also my lifelong interest in Gnosticism, to which this scripture has a close relationship. It is important to keep in mind that all references to the exegesis of the Seven Sermons, including my own, that originate prior to the present time, were uninformed concerning the larger context and various details of the sermons as present in the Red Book, in the third part of the Red Book, which is called Scrutinies. In Scrutinies, the Seven Sermons begins with a dialogue between Jung and his soul. You will recollect that such dialogues occur throughout the Red Book, and in fact the Red Book starts with one, and so they recur again and again. Let me see where that might be. Just 1 minute. But I remained anxious and confused for many days, and my soul remained silent and was not to be seen. But one night a dark crowd knocked at my door, and I trembled with fear. Then my soul appeared and said in haste, "They are here and will tear open your door," which seems to be a sort of standard way of introducing a bunch of spooks when they come. "They are here." You may remember it from some Hollywood event of some years ago. "They are here and will tear open your door, so that the wicked herd can break into my garden. Should I be plundered and thrown out onto the street, you make me into an ape and a child's plaything." He argues in his usual fashion with his soul again. "When, O my God, shall I be saved from this hell of fools?" A question that many of us have asked under various circumstances in the course of our lives, and probably will continue to do so. "But I want to hack to pieces your cursed webs. What do you want with me?" But she interrupted and said, "What are you talking about? Let the dark ones speak." I retorted, "How can I trust you? You work for yourself, not for me. What good are you, if you can't even protect me from the devil's confusion?" "Be quiet," she replied, "or else you will disturb the work." Now, what she is referring to, of course, is something that Jung had recounted in some detail in his autobiographical work, Memories, Dreams and Reflections, wherein he stated how after a period of disquiet and some strange dreams on the parts of his children and other kinds of signs, although not wonders, the doorbell rang violently at his door in Küsnacht, and when he opened the door, he heard many voices saying, "We have come back from Jerusalem, where we have not found what we were seeking." And with that, the dead came into the house. And that is when the seven sermons were delivered to the dead, which in the little book that he published for his friends, the sermons were poetically attributed to Basilides of Alexandria, a historical figure about whom not a great deal is known, who was an important Gnostic teacher, but as we will see here, the person associated with the sermons and making commentaries upon it is not really Basilides, but Philemon. At the same time, I think we may justly wonder why Jung should have chosen a nom de plume for his mystical interior master Philemon, the name of Basilides. And the likelihood exists that he has done so because Basilides was a great Gnostic master, and Philemon, he also considered a Gnostic master, albeit not of a historical nature. So we need to remember that Jung does encounter the crowd of the dead, which are mentioned earlier in the Red Book. So earlier in the Red Book, you will find the passage where a crowd of the dead come to see Jung, and they are led by a blind Anabaptist preacher named Ezekiel, and that after talking with Jung, they depart for a journey to Jerusalem. So when they say, "We have come back from Jerusalem," now we know that they have appeared before, that they had made some representations to him at that time, and now they came back. They have returned, and Jung, as you just noted, rather reluctantly admits them into his house after the several paranormal phenomena and so forth, which incidentally are also described in the earlier portion of my book, The Gnostic Jung. So coming back to the sermons as present in the scrutinies of the Red Book, it needs to be noted that in the version published by Jung early in the 20th century, in the little book that I mentioned to you before, the teacher instructing the dead Basilides is mentioned, and he is the one who then gives the sermons to the dead and discourses with them to a certain extent. It is even stated in the earlier version of the sermons that they are translated from the original Greek text into the German language. So Jung was, you know, pulling a little trickster-like sort of scholarly fiction, so that if somebody would pick up that book, they would say, "Oh, well, it's a translation of some old Greek text." But of course, his friends, to whom he made the book available, all knew that it really came from him. Even if, let's say, if I wrote some kind of a treatise and, I don't know, attributed to Attila the Hun, or to Count Dracula or something like that, both of them being ancestors of the Hungarian people, well, you would understand that these nom de plumes are just that. So the reason for this disguise originally put forth by Jung are, of course, impossible to ascertain. As I noted before, Basilides was a historical figure, Philemon was not. Jung did not wish that readers of the original publication should inquire regarding the Red Book, because only maybe two or three people were, as far as I can recall at this moment, were aware of that, and he did not want that to be further publicized, which is also understandable. Thus, Philemon's comments regarding the sermons are omitted in the previous publication. They are omitted, I would say, quite obviously, because nobody would have known who read that book, who Philemon was, because they did not know the red book, you see. So thus we need to concern ourselves further with the seven sermons as presented in the scrutinies section of the red book. Philemon now delivers the first sermon to the dead. In conformity with the cosmology of many Gnostic scriptures, the supreme reality of a transcosmic region envisioned by the Gnostics is what they called the Pleroma. And that is, of course, what the first sermon consists of. Cosmological and cosmogonic myths, let us say, abound in the Gnostic scriptures. And they are almost inevitably presented, so to say, from the top down, from the highest and the most subtle and most transcendental regions, step by step down to the physical level. And Jung's seven sermons follow that same example. Now, pleroma is a Greek word that translates as fullness, whereby is meant a fullness of all realities and potentialities, the unmanifest fountain and origin of manifestation. This sort of thing is difficult and indeed perhaps even impossible to deal with at a rational level, but then so is the entire Red Book. So it's really, when you go to the Red Book, you should put your rationalistic tendencies and hang them up on a peg before you read the book. You can put them on afterwards again. And so, in another brief definition, pleroma is described in a very reputable dictionary of philosophy, is described as a transcendental field, which is the only true ultimate reality from which emerge manifest realms of beings in series with properties revealing the supreme fullness. In the scrutinies of the Red Book version of the sermons, the first sermon begins as follows, with Philemon rather than Basilides speaking. Now here, I begin with nothingness. Nothingness is the same as fullness. In infinity, full is as good as empty. This is Dr. Shamdasani's translation. Mine is a little bit different. By the way, if you don't own the Red Book, for a very much smaller price, you can get one of my books and you will have a good translation in it. It was acknowledged as such by various people, including Dr. Shamdasani. It's a little, a little different wording. Now, and then he goes on to say, you might as well say anything else about nothingness, for instance, that it is white or black, or that it does not exist, or that it exists. That which is endless and eternal has no qualities, since it has all qualities. This is part one of the first of the seven sermons. Now, just because the seven sermons are available in my translation and by now probably in others, I have chosen not to read all the sermons to you here again. You can read those for yourself. So I summarize and I comment with some quotations. The entire first sermon continues in a similar vein, affirming all along that the pleroma is a state wherein all potentialities are present, and in fact wherein the pairs of opposites which we are familiar with exist only potentially because they cancel each other out. So some of these pairs of opposites which exist at a lower or manifest level, but which are cancelled out or suspended and therefore not active in the fullness which he mentions, are the effective and the ineffective, the fullness and the emptiness, the living and the dead, the different and the same, light and darkness, hot and cold, force and matter, time and space, good and evil, the beautiful and the ugly, the one and the many, and so forth. Now, in order for you to envision this in a manner in which it is intended, I'll just depict for you verbally and hope that you can readily imagine it, because it's really a very simple design, a diagram which was given to me many years ago in Australia by the late and lamented Professor John Cooper, a very, very wonderful and learned man with whom I shared a seminar that we were presenting. And he drew a design which in effect is very similar to, or is pretty much identical with, the Egyptian cross of life, or Ankh. You know what that looks like. It's a circle on top. Then right immediately on the circle there is a horizontal line, and then there is a vertical line that proceeds down. You find it in the Egyptian images and hieroglyphics all over the place, although that same design has also been used by other people in other parts of the world. For instance, by the Qatars in the Languedoc and others. And then it usually stands for the human being, as the round circle being the head, the shoulders and the arms being here, and then the trunk. Now, what Professor Cooper said, that this is a way in which we can envision the Gnostic cosmology. At the top is a circle, which is the pleroma, or the fullness. The circle with its center everywhere and circumference nowhere, as God has been defined by some of the Christian mystics subsequently. Then there is a division, which in Greek is often called the horos, and which is the line of demarcation that separates the absolute being and non-being, the pleroma, from the emanations or manifestations that exist at a lower level. Now, the important thing to remember is that as that vertical line goes down, like the trunk of a tree, or like, like the middle pillar of the tree of life, on each side there are innumerable binaries or opposites, or as the Greek word calls them, syzygies. So really the manifest world in terms of consciousness is split in half by that vertical line. And there are all these good and bad, light and dark, male and female, beautiful and ugly, every kind of oppositional binary that you can imagine can be placed there on the two sides facing each other of this vertical line. But above the line of division, in the circle, this does not exist. They are there potentially, but they cancel each other out. So this is then the initial difference between the pleroma, the fullness, and the lower regions, which were sometimes called kenoma, the emptiness. Empty of what? Well, empty of the fullness. So that is what he's speaking about here, but he's speaking about this supreme existence, this supreme region. However, a portentous statement comes forth a few lines further in the first sermon. We are, however, the pleroma itself, for we are a part of the eternal and the endless. So even that very ultimate, totally transcendental, extremely mysterious field of being, in an equally mysterious manner, is also present within us. And this, of course, is of extreme importance from Jung's point of view. And it's certainly also implied and sometimes specifically stated in the Gnostic scriptures. So, somewhat paraphrasing a famous statement of Goethe, the great German poet who said, "Willst du denn ins Unendliche schreiten, dann geh noch schnell nach allen Seiten." If you want to enter the endless, then move in all directions, especially within yourself. You see? If you want to find the Pleroma, look deeply enough within yourself. Of course, it's so indistinct that you'll have a hard time distinguishing it. But it is there as a great, tremendous potential of power. You know? There are somewhat analogous notions and concepts in various other spiritual systems, where, for instance, it is said that the ultimate fullness is somewhat like an uncarved block. I think that's a Chinese and Taoist metaphor. In the uncarved block, all kinds of things are present, potentially, but none of them are there actually. So the artist can look at it and say, oh dear, I could carve a little dog out of this, I could carve a man out of this, I could carve a woman out of this, and whatever, I could carve a giraffe out of this, but they are all there potentially. So it's not a bad metaphor for that sort of thing. To the anxious queries of the dead, who are a very dense group, he answers that all thought, all definitions, all attempts at differentiation in the mind are antithetical to the Pleroma, that we must strive for one thing only in this regard, and that is our own essence. He uses the term essence, which of course is also a philosophical expression if you go back to Schopenhauer, Kant, and various other people. Whether it is meant in that philosophical way or not, we are not really sure. One of the important statements made is, at bottom, therefore, there is only one striving, namely the striving for one's own essence. So that all the movements of consciousness, all the desires and movements and intentionalities of our nature, when stripped of their external covering, so to say, point to our striving for our essence. Very interesting. So he goes on, since, however, thought, thinking alienates us from our essence, I must teach you that knowledge with which you can bridle your thoughts. Something that will keep your thoughts back, keep them confined, keep them restrained. What knowledge is that? Well, the word, the Greek word for knowledge is gnosis. So we have here reiterated again in another way that the power of thinking will keep us from knowing our essence. Is that so wild, or is that, let's say, a way of telling us that we ought to be non-thinking beings, that we ought to be, as we might say somewhat simplistically, just basically stupid? No. And moreover, it is a truism that is present in a lot of spiritual systems. In the biggest and the best known and probably oldest classics on yoga, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, we have the statement right at the beginning that yoga has to do with the restraining of the thinking principle. So what does that mean? Well, if we just do a little bit of self-observation, which is never a bad thing, even if we don't follow old Georgi Gurdjieff, who made much of it, but we soon find that our thinking principle is constantly active. We are constantly thinking thoughts, churning out thoughts and discarding thoughts, and it just goes on and on and on and on. Therefore, if we are to penetrate to something much deeper than that, namely to the core, to the essence of our being, then somehow we have to get past that particular barrier. We have to brush this thought-out trash out of the way. And that is precisely what he is speaking about here. Then he finishes this long and mysterious and abstract first sermon, and the dead are obviously not very happy. This is too weird and too abstract for them. And so the dead faded away, grumbling and moaning, and their cries died away in the distance. Jung then continues his previously secret narrative, namely the narrative that has to do now with Philemon's commentary, Philemon's reactions to the dead. You need to remember, Philemon is the one who delivered the sermons to begin with. Now the dead have oozed away, and so now Philemon talks to Jung. And Jung, more importantly, Jung questions Philemon, as he is wont to do, with great energy and often in a rather irreverent manner. So, but I turned to Philemon and said, "My father, you utter strange teachings. Did not the ancients teach similar things? And was it not a reprehensible heresy, removed equally from love and the truth? And why do you lay out such a teaching to this horde, which the night wind swirled up from the dark blood fields of the West?" So, obviously there is, you know, quite a bit of tongue-in-cheek there. So what he really speaks of is, well, didn't the ancient teach similar things? Well, the ancient Gnostics and Hermeticists. And he sort of ostensibly repeats the sayings of the heresiological church fathers, reprehensible heresy which is removed equally from love and the truth. And these are precisely the things that Irenaeus and Eusebius and Epiphanius and similar people were accusing the Gnostics of. So he brings these things up in order to get a reaction from Philemon. "My son," Philemon replied, "these dead ended their lives too early. These were seekers and therefore still hover over their graves. Their lives were incomplete, since they knew no way beyond the one to which belief had abandoned them." To which belief had abandoned them. It's not that they abandoned the belief, although they did. "But since no one teaches them, I must do so. That is what love demands, since they want it to hear, even if they grumble. But why do I impart this teaching of the ancients? I teach in this way because their Christian faith, once discarded and persecuted, precisely this teaching." This is what they were lacking. This is what they have never been allowed to hear and to deal with. That's why I tell it to them. "But they now," that is the dead, "repudiated Christian belief, and hence were rejected by that faith. They do not know this, and therefore I must teach them, so that their life may be fulfilled and they can enter into death." So, a little more about that later, but obviously what we have here are not dead as we consider the dead. These are not spooks, but they are us. They are us, and they are spiritually dead. And moreover, they are what? They are people of our cultural background who have become secularized. They no longer go along with Christian belief. They have nothing. In this respect, it's probably useful to remember that Jung had said more than once that all of his patients, pretty much, were people who had become secularized. The people who were really religious, Christians or Jews and so forth, they were taken care of. But others were not. And Jung, for instance, also said, of course, you got to remember, we are going back to the early part of the 20th century, that the Catholics who had practiced confession, the sacrament of penance, didn't need any psychoanalysis, not even his, because they had a technique that took care of that sort of thing. But the people who, in for one reason or the other, have risen out of that milieu, who no longer can go along with those things, those are the ones to whom Jung and Philemon need to give their discourses. Now Jung says to Philemon, you know, he always seems to want to have the last word, dear old Jung. But do you, O wise Philemon, believe what you teach? Interesting question. My son, Philemon replied, why do you raise this question? How could I teach what I believe? Who would give me the right to such belief? It is what I know how to say, not because I believe it, but because I know it. Little difference here between belief and knowing. If I knew better, I would teach better. I have to remember that, you know. You know, when people come to me, yeah, well, you know, why are you saying that? Well, you know what? If I knew better, I would teach better. Very good words, Father Philemon, very good words. But it would be easy for me to believe more. Yet should I teach a belief to those who have discarded belief? And I ask you, is it good to believe something even more if one does not know better? So, obviously, implicit and explicitly stated here is the issue that, you see, our culture has gone for a long time with belief. What it needs now is something other than belief. And to just replace one system of belief with another will not do. Because the issue is not the content of the belief, but the act of belief itself, which is, well, if not totally counterproductive, still not really productive of what Philemon wants to do. Belief will not lead where he wants to lead you. That's what he's saying here. But, I retorted, are you certain that things really are as you say? And sort of Jung kind of looks to me here like a little Swiss hobbit, you know, sort of with his hands in his pocket, you know, looks up and talks to big old Philemon, you know. But there is method in that kind of madness too, as you have seen it throughout the book, because it's not that sort of reverent, unquestioning taking in of everything that the teacher says, which is probably more the way of the East. Oh, great guru, tell us more, you know. So, but no, he talks back and he questions and he goads the teacher into more the kind of teaching that he wants to hear. So, are you certain that things really are as you say? To this, Philemon answered, I do not know whether it is the best that one can know, but I know nothing better. And therefore I am certain these things are as I say. If they are otherwise, I would say something else, since I would know them to be otherwise. But these things are as I know them, since my knowledge is precisely these things themselves. So he defines really his gnosis here. My father, is that your guarantee that you are not mistaken? There are no mistakes in these things, Philemon replied. There are only different levels of knowledge. These things are as you know them. Only in your world are things always other than you know them. and therefore there are only mistakes in your world. After these words, Philemon bent down and touched the earth with his hands and disappeared. Quite a story. This is one of the commentaries that did not appear in the original printed booklet. In this commentary, Jung, in a likely tongue-in-cheek manner, tells Philemon that all this sounds much like the condemned heresy of the ancient Gnostics, as I noted before. Philemon replies in so many words, "Yes, and what of it? Since the dead had now rejected and have been rejected by conventional Christianity, it is precisely this teaching that they need." Philemon also affirms, as against Jung's questions, that he says these things not because he believes in them, but because he knows them. He also says that he knows nothing better, and therefore he is certain these things are as he says. There are no mistakes in these things. There are only different levels of knowledge. Very, very, very profound saying. Philemon speaks with the conviction of a pneumatic Gnostic whose gnosis can only be doubted in vain. Also, he speaks like Jung did throughout much of his career to souls who have abandoned a religious orthodoxy with the intention that their life may be fulfilled and they can, as he says, enter into death. So Jung's future career and its purposes are thus powerfully indicated here by Philemon. Thus we progress to the second sermon. Maybe just another commentary, not by Philemon, but myself, that I think it's a very interesting, comforting notion that, if we come to think of it, that in these matters, there isn't really so much truth and error as there are different levels of understanding and knowing. So, say, if I am a Gnostic, which I hope I am, I try to be in any event, you know, I shouldn't look down on some form of Orthodox Christian, even an evangelical, and heaven forbid even at a fundamentalist, and say to him, "Brother, you're wrong." But I should rather say to myself, these people know and understand at a particular level. And that level is not mine, you see. But of course it would also be just really very, very nice if they could say the same thing of me. But they won't. I assure you, they won't. But truly there are sort of reductionistic, factualized way of looking at things, looking at the greater issues of life. And they are valid up to a certain point. The problem with them is not that they are not true, but that they don't go far enough. And then there are others which are intellectually, philosophically, ethically, logically quite valid. But again, they don't go far enough. When you use those arguments and then you sit down and think a little, they leave something to be desired. You feel that you haven't quite gotten where you wanted to go. And that is how you eventually, or in some manner or the other, come to the deeper and maybe eventually to the deepest levels of understanding. And it's from that level, so it would seem, that Philemon is speaking. So we move on now to the next sermon, which is the second sermon. So the first one was about the Pleroma. And the dead were pretty unhappy with it, and they grumbled and howled, which they like to do. And now the dead come and stand in the room, as Jung says, lining the walls, while Philemon stands beside Jung. The dead ask, "We want to know about God. Where is God? Is God dead?" I would say the dead have studied Nietzsche. Who, after all, was very famous at that time when this was written. So, is God dead? Philemon then expounds a theogony that consists of a supernal duality. He says, no, this is what you need to know about the divine. This is what you need to know about God. He starts out with a supernal duality. He says there are two deities. They are Helios, which is the Greek name for the sun god, the god of light, the god of the sun, who incidentally, I mean, just as this is neither here nor there because it's in Greece, but I had a good friend, late good friend, who lived in Greece for a considerable period of time. And he noted a curious circumstance that as he was, you know, he was a big hiker and he climbed around all the mountains of the various islands in the Peloponnesus there, that on the mountain tops and the tops of hills, there always the Greeks built a little chapel, Orthodox Greek chapel. And that virtually all the chapels on the tops of the mountains were dedicated to Saint Elias, Elijah. And he said, Elias, because the H is not pronounced, so that it's a carryover, because that's from where you can see the sun. That's where the sun shines directly. So, you know, very, very big, very ancient archetype of light. So he says, there is Helios, the sun god, and his opposite number, who is a demon or a devil, a god of darkness. God and this devil figure are the first manifestations of nothingness, which we call the Pleroma. This is then apparently where the opposites no longer cancel each other out, but begin to appear. A feeble analogy might be the Chinese Dao, which we might equate with the Pleroma, from which come the yin and the yang. From the one come the two. And from the two come the 10,000 myriad things, as the Tao Te Ching, I believe, says. Although we need to remember that the yin is, the dark yin in Taoism, has no demonic character. Philemon also calls the primordial duality the effective fullness, which is Helios, not just the potential, but the effective fullness, and the effective emptiness, which is its opposite. In the latter part of the second sermon, Jung also indicates the presence of a third principle. The God you know nothing about, because mankind has forgotten him. We call him by his name Abraxas. And he continues in some considerable detail describing this strange deity then in the third sermon, which is entirely devoted to Abraxas. I was so taken with Abraxas when I wrote my commentaries on the seven sermons that I devoted two chapters to that one sermon, to none of the others. So we can state here with some assurance of certainty and accuracy, I think, that Jung and his inspirer Philemon is developing a Gnostic theogonic cosmological system here, which certainly possesses many of the spiritual features of the ancient Gnosis, but which has certain features which are different from the ancient Gnostic systems. Whether one is of Gnostic disposition or not, such differences need not be disturbing. Gnostics have always expressed their Gnosis in metaphorical and symbolic systems of their own, which often, at least in some respects, differ from each other. This has led some people rather ill-advisedly, I feel, to make statements that there is no such thing as Gnosticism because there are so many different systems. Yet, we need to keep in mind, as I like to repeat whenever I'm given an opportunity, that when some systems or stories or narratives have more in common with each other than they do with anything else, then we are justified in assuming a close relationship and perhaps even considering them as being justly named under an umbrella term. And I think that that is quite an accurate way of looking at the situation. In the second part of the second sermon already, Jung introduces this principle or personage whom he calls Abraxas. Both from the text of the sermon, and particularly the third sermon, we learn about a sort of deity that is characterized by ambivalence, a union of light and dark, and indeed a dynamic unity and unifier of all dualities. Several issues need to be faced here. One is the fact that in using the word God, and this we really have to keep in mind from now on when dealing with the sermons, Jung departs from the monotheistic God image of Christianity and to a lesser extent of Judaism. Why do I say lesser extent when, after all, Judaism claims to be, with some considerable justification, the paramount monotheistic religion? Oh, yes. But if you look into Jewish theology on a fairly universal basis, for instance, you will find that, unlike in Christianity, the Lord God possesses yesirim, as they are called in Hebrew, which are tendencies. And the Lord God possesses both a good and an evil tendency. Now, the Christian, that is unthinkable. How could the Lord God, the Father of Jesus Christ, how could he have anything evil in him? But in Judaism, it's present. So, in that respect, and in that respect only, the Jewish God, shall we say, if there is such a thing, is like Jung's Abraxas. He has both light and darkness within him. In fact, he delights in the interaction and the commingling and the mixing up in his, as I envision him in his great alchemical pot, of all of these various elements. Because you are dealing here with an extremely dynamic figure. So Jung speaks of something else here. The notion of a singular, all-good, and all-powerful God, who at once is creator, lawgiver, judge, and executioner, is unacceptable to Philemon and to his disciple Jung. Instead of this God, Philemon's gnosis mentions in the first sermon an unknowable, impersonal, ultimate reality, the pleroma. You want to look upon that as God? You can. But it has certain characteristics which are certainly very different from the personalized God image of various monotheistic religions. So this reality is the ultimate unity of all opposites. It does not create, although creative principles may mysteriously emanate from it. At the manifest and at least partially differentiated level, there are other deities, such as the two supreme expressions of light and dark, which he calls Helios and the demon. Then there is an awesome, extremely powerful deity in whom or which the opposites carry on their reconciliation or and union in a very dynamic way. This is the one whom the sermons call Abraxas. The dead are obviously those humans who have come to reject the Judeo-Christian monotheistic God. But on the other hand, it has been so long ago that anyone had any kind of an idea similar to Abraxas, that is the God whom people have forgotten about. So they don't have that either. To these dead, he brings a certain kind of gnosis. By perceiving Abraxas, they, that is the dead, behold the reality that is less benign than the good monotheistic God, but it is still a reality that is non-material, supernatural, and thus at a deeper, much, much deeper level than atheism or even a naturalistic pantheism. Thus Philemon takes the consciousness of the so-called dead to a deeper level. And thus we move on to the third sermon, where the dead approach like fog from a swamp and exclaim, "Tell us more about the highest God." In response to this request, Philemon then delivers now the third sermon, which contains an awesome enumeration of opposites and of images of cosmic and transcosmic energy, all of these connected with whom he calls Abraxas. In this sermon, Abraxas is described by some awesome and at times frightening images. Some of these are what the sun god Helios speaks life, what the devil speaks is death. That's, you know, the opposite, the darkness. But Abraxas speaks the hallowed and accursed word that is at once life and death. He is splendid as the lion in the instant he strikes down his victim. He is as beautiful as a spring day. So, great power, great energy, and quite outside of the moral and certainly moralizing categories that humanity so often associates with deities, even though that may not be true of a lot of deities in the Hindu and in the Mahayana Buddhist pantheon. He is the fullness that seeks union with emptiness. He is the delight of the earth and the cruelty of the heavens. He is the monster of the underworld, a thousand-armed polyp, a twisted knot of winged serpents, frenzy. Schlangengewirbelraserei, as he would say. The twisting of the winged serpents and madness. Reminds me of some scenes with snakes that I used to observe when I was young. They really know how to twist in a great ball and do weird things. And perhaps more significantly, to look upon him is blindness. To worship him is death. To fear him is wisdom. Not to resist him is redemption. So the second and the third sermons thus present a conundrum. It is well known that, as far as we can tell, all classical Gnostic schools believed in a demiurge, which literally means half-maker. Demi, you know, like a demijohn, you know, things like that. Demi-monde, half-world, so forth. And then Urgos, the half-maker, the demiurge, who was seen as a creator and a manager of the universe, but of limited wisdom and at times seen as possessing tyrannical tendencies. In fact, the accounts in the Old Testament of the Hebrew God were often recognized by the Gnostics as referring to the demiurge. Now, there were found, primarily in Egypt over the years, numerous amulets depicting usually a being with the head of a rooster, legs of a snake, and the torso of a man. The name Abraxas and at times Sabaoth and sometimes both were appended to this figure. Now, virtually no description of any kind of a narrative nature was available in the literature about this figure prior to the Nag Hammadi discovery. A figure with the head of a lion and the body of a serpent was also discovered at times. When Jung wrote the sermons in 1916, this was about all that could be discovered about Abraxas. It is most likely, therefore, that Jung's or Philemon's use of the name Abraxas was justified by the, the somewhat inadequate knowledge of this figure in the scholarship of that time. The second and third sermons show a being that may very well be a vision of the Gnostic demiurge. Since that time, a variation of the theme of Abraxas Sabaoth was discovered in two of the major scriptures of the Nag Hammadi collection, namely the hypostasis of the Archons and on the origin of the world. You can find those in any collection of the Nag Hammadi scriptures. In these scriptures we find the figure represented usually as a son of the demiurge Yaldabaoth, who repents of all dark demiurgic deeds, comes to worship the celestial mother Sophia, and is rewarded by receiving light and becoming the ruler of the seventh heaven, the Lord of the powers. It would seem that Jung's or Philemon's image of Abraxas is a sort of conflation of these two figures, even though at the conscious level, in all likelihood, after all we can never be totally certain, in all likelihood Jung had no knowledge of the redeemed Archon or demiurgic figure Abraxas that appears in these two scriptures of Nag Hammadi. Nevertheless, thus Philemon's Abraxas is a cosmocrator, that is, creator of cosmos, of creative energy, and also a worker for liberation and transcosmic light and freedom. The Abraxas of the sermons is an ambivalent deific figure. Jung, incidentally, had a large ring which he had made. He didn't take I'm sure there would have been available to him some of the old Egyptian Abraxas stones, but he had one made depicting a lion-headed, serpentine-bodied being, and the lion's head is surrounded by a halo with, I believe, 12 spikes, which would indicate the zodiac. Now, the dead respond to the third sermon, where he teaches about Abraxas, by howling and raging, because they are, as the text says, incomplete ones. So if you are put off by the figure of Abraxas in any way, I was always inspired by it. Not only the image, but the image in the seven sermons is just, you know, incredible, creative, powerful, wild being. Thoroughly exciting as far as I am concerned. But of course, if you like a kind of meek and mild, pallid, anemic kind of deity, well, then you're not going to go with Abraxas. It's quite evident, you know. But the dead certainly weren't very happy with it at all. So Jung, as so often, is puzzled, and he asks Philemon, "How, O my father, should I understand this God?" Philemon responds in typical Gnostic fashion, "This God is to be known, but not understood." A phrase that, after a fashion, may be applied, I think, to the entire Red Book. Let me try to explain that. Of course, these are semantic issues, but behind the semantics, I think there is something quite important. When we try to, quote, understand, we run the risk of converting the vision into theory, into intellectual categories, an activity that I dare say is taking place in many places right now. I would say in the overwhelming, and now I'll make a great prophecy after all. I got to be a prophet a little bit too now and then. So I'll make a great prophecy that the overwhelming majority of the exegetical efforts about the Red Book, some of them are already on the internet and so forth, are going to be just of that nature. People are going to look at Jung's visions and they are trying to put them into theoretical categories. They are trying to make theory out of them. And if Jung were around or Philemon were around, I think Jung would smite them with a large rock extracted from the Swiss Alps. Because that's precisely what is not to be done. So if you take my word for it, which is certainly not required necessarily, I would say that at least one of the important tasks of this book is to awaken your own visionary nature. Now, you may not see visions with the same power and for the same length of time as Jung, otherwise you would probably, I don't know, have to give up your job if you haven't lost it already because of the economy and so forth, because you would have to devote yourself to it so much. But it definitely exists, at least in part, for the purpose of stimulating that kind of visionary insightful quality within yourself. And to the extent that you have the vision, then you know. If you don't, or if you chase that away and try to reduce these things to intellectual categories of one kind or the other, even if those intellectual categories are those of Jungian psychology, then I think you have done the Red Book an injustice. That is not what it is intended to do. The final question and answer exchange, so to say, between Jung and Philemon regarding the third sermon is as follows. I replied, "Why, O solemn one, do you call the eternally incomprehensible the cruel contradictoriness of nature, God?" And you need to remember, I didn't share all of these with you, because as I see, you can find them elsewhere. But for instance, this is how the third sermon ends. And you can see how that would arouse these kinds of considerations. "That is the terrible Abraxas. He is the mightiest created being, and in him creation is frightened of itself. He is the manifest opposition of creation to the Pleroma and its nothingness. He is the son's horror of the mother. He is the mother's love for the son. He is the delight of the earth and the cruelty of the heavens. At his sight, man's face congeals." Now that's pretty dangerous. "Before him there is no question and no reply. He is the life of creation. He is the effect of differentiation. He is the love of man. He is the speech of man. He is the appearance and the shadow of man. He is deceptive reality." And at that point the dead howled and raged, for they were incomplete. So, you know, I mean, on the basis of this, you can really ask the kind of question that Jung asks here. Philemon said, "How should I name it otherwise? If the overpowering essence of events in the universe and in the hearts of men were law, I would call it law. Yet it is also no law, but chance, irregularity, sin, error, stupidity, carelessness, folly, illegality." I would say lawlessness, but anyway. "Therefore, I cannot call it law. You know that this must be so, and at the same time you know that it did not have to be so, and that at some other time it will not be so. It is overpowering and occurs as if from eternal law, and at another time a slanting wind blows a speck of dust into the works, and this void is a superior strength harder than a mountain of iron. Therefore you know that the eternal law is also no law. So I cannot call it law. But how else should it be named? I know that human language has forever named the maternal womb of the incomprehensible God. Truly this God is and is not, since from being and non-being everything emerged that was, is, and will be. But when Philemon had spoken the last word, he touched the earth with his hand and dissolved." So there he is gone. So we find here Jung's refutation, I feel, of the obsession of 19th century thinking that continued into the 20th, that postulated the existence of inexorable laws of nature and of the universe, according to which everything is supposed to take place. You have no doubt come across those statements. So Philemon justifies his use of the word God when applied to Abraxas, who works within the eternal law that is also no law. Chance, irregularity, sin, error, stupidity, carelessness, folly, lawlessness are all present and mitigate against an absolute belief in law. This obsession with law, and I'm not talking about law passed by Congress or things like that, but law as a cosmic reality was really the answer of the materialistic, scientifically oriented mind to the terrible void left by atheism. You know, where there is no recognition of some kind of a divine consciousness, then you try to substitute something for it. And what was substituted was law. Coming clear back from Newtonian times and so forth. Well, you know, we may not have an ultimate cause, or, you know, we may not have a creator any longer, but everything works according to law. The great cosmic clockwork. Well, as time went on, it became more and more evident that that is not a very realistic image either. And so I think Jung nowadays would probably have some affinity with the contemporary views of chaos theory and so forth. You know, not everything works according to law. So the following night, the dead appear rather early, and they run and fill the place with their mutterings and address Philemon in the following somewhat impolite manner. Speak to us about gods and devils, thou accursed one. Philemon appears and delivers the fourth sermon. Responding to the request of the dead, Jung now enumerates several binaries, or as they were called in ancient Gnostic times, syzygies. Now we come to yet a lower level. The ones described here once again are the sun god Helios and his opposite number, the demon. Below these he notes two other deities, which he calls the burning one, also Eros, and the growing one, which he names the tree of life. So it's not the old duality of Eros and Logos. In enumerating them, he says, the number of gods and devils is innumerable as the host of the stars. By the way, the word he uses here, and it's translated, I think I translated that way too, is from the German Teufel, which means devil, but again, there is a sort of understood meaning of that word, which is not quite theological in nature. Languages have a certain way of using words idiosyncratically which cannot be translated. And so it really means here an opposite of the conventional God. The conventional God creates, the Teufel uncreates. One makes light, the other one sucks the light and eats it up. So there's this kind of duality that goes on. And then, in enumerating them, he says, the number of gods and devils is innumerable, as the host of the stars. Each star is a god, and each space that a star fills is a demon. But the empty fullness of the whole is the pleroma, the background. The reality from which they all come and into which they fade in due course. Abraxas is the effect of the whole, and only the ineffective opposes him. Four is the number of the principal gods, as four is the number of the world's measurements. One is the beginning, the sun god. Two is Eros, for he binds the two together and spreads himself out in brightness. Three is the tree of life, for it fills space and bodies. This is not to be confused with the Kabbalistic tree of life. For is the devil, for he opens all that is closed. He dissolves everything formed and physical. He is the destroyer in whom everything becomes nothing. This is somewhat like the destructive aspect of Shiva, for instance, in Hinduism. It is rather obvious that when the sermons use the word God or gods, they mean something very, very different from the monotheistic God concept. And polytheistic imagery is similar to the Hindu pantheon or the Buddhist notion of what are called deities would be akin. The quasi-polytheistic keynote is struck again in the following, also from the fourth sermon. Happy am I, who can recognize the multiplicity and diversity of the gods. But woe unto you, who replace this diversity with the oneness of God, for the diversity cannot be resolved into the one. This is followed by further imprecations against the excesses of monotheism, which diminishes the diversity and riches of the spiritual presences in the universe. The dead are so upset by all this that they interrupt Philemon with shouts and angry, derisive laughter and depart. What an unpleasant group. Jung then, in his usual manner, confronts Philemon once more. And it is quite an interesting one. O Philemon, I believe you are mistaken. It seems that you teach a raw superstition, which the fathers had successfully and gloriously overcome. You can see that this is tongue-in-cheek, that's the church fathers, gloriously overcome. That polytheism, which a mind produces only when it cannot free its gaze from the force of compulsive desire chained to sensory things. My son, Philemon replied, these dead have rejected the single and highest God. So how can I teach them about the one, only, and not multifarious God? They must, of course, believe me, but they have rejected their belief. So I teach them the God that I know, the multifarious and extended, who is both the thing and its appearance. And they also know him even if they are not conscious of him. So what Philemon does at the end of the discourse, wait a minute, yeah, we are not quite there yet. Philemon then continues to discourse about the arrogance of the men who the dead once were. They sacrificed the many wonders of the deities. This is sort of a kick against early Christianity, They catalogued nature and the universe instead of admiring the spiritual forces of the deities. They turned, scientific. Everything's got to be catalogued. Instead of mystical admiration, they came to practice a kind of cosmic bookkeeping. And I think that we know what we mean by that. They have, as we might say today, prosaicize the world and the universe, and then they became materialists. Philemon thus makes monotheism responsible for making life and the world appear humdrum and prosaic, and finally for materialism. Now, my second love after religion has always been history. And I am confident that I could make a terrific cause for the veracity of that statement in historical terms. That when you begin to intellectualize and thereby prosaicize religion, as Christianity has done over a long period of time, and then of course Protestantism made it worse, and eventually it becomes a reductio ad absurdum, and then people say to hell with this. And justly so, And that's really what has happened. You can, for instance, see how the German Protestant theologians, once they got into the higher biblical criticism and so forth, they really put themselves and their God and their religion ultimately out of business. Because they managed to analyze religion to such a point that it became meaningless. People said to hell with it. You know, this is what happens when, instead of pursuing these spiritual matters spiritually, you pursue them intellectually and then eventually materially, and then it's finished. That's really quite true. Now then he continues, Philemon continues, let's see now, see. Your hand grasped the earth. He's telling again what humanity has done. Your hand grasped the earth and tore off the halo and weighed and numbered the bones of things. It is not the one and only simple-minded God pulled down and thrown into a heap, the massed seeming of separate things, dead and living. Yes, this God taught you to weigh and number bones, but the month of this God is drawing to a close. The new month stands at the door. Therefore, everything had to be as it is, and hence everything must become different. This is no polytheism that I have made up, but many gods who powerfully raise their voices and tear humanity to bloody pieces. So and so many men, weighed, numbered, apportioned, hacked and devoured. Therefore I speak of many gods as I speak of many things, since I know them. Why do I call them gods? For the sake of their superiority. Do you know about this superior strength? Now is the time when you can learn. These dead laugh at my foolishness, but would they have raised the murderer's hand against their brothers if they had atoned for the ox with their velvet eyes? He speaks earlier about the sacrifices, the bloody sacrifices in the temple and so forth. If they had done penance for the shiny ore, if they had worshipped the holy trees, if they had made peace with the soul of the golden-eyed frog, what say things dead and living? Who is greater, man or the gods? Truly this sun has become a moon, and no new sun has arisen from the contractions of the last hour of the night. A lot could be said about that, but we don't have either the time or the opportunity. But then something interesting happens. It may not be interesting to everybody, but it caught my attention right away. And when he finished these words, Philemon bent down to the earth, kissed it and said, Mother, may your son be strong. Then he stood, looked up to the heavens and said, How dark is your place of the new light. Then he disappeared. Well, what he does here, he repeats in a somewhat abbreviated form of a story of Simon Magus. Simon Magus, the flying magician, the first of the Gnostics, according to tradition. There's a story about Simon. Simon knew how to fly. So Simon came and bent down on the ground and kissed the earth and said, Mother, make me strong and let me go. And then he had the strength and he flew to the heavens. And he went and visited the stars and then he came back and told the earth what he had seen. There it is. So at this point, in a very subtle and mythic manner, Jung tells us that Philemon is Simon Magus. And there'll be more about that. So these are really the first three, and actually in part the first four sermons. As you can see, they are a mythic psycho-spiritual cosmos. And as we will continue with them and see the latter one, we will see their much more direct and extremely powerful application to the individual human being and his life. And I am quite convinced, as are other, I think, well-informed students of the Red Book, that the seven sermons, as Jung actually said in so many words himself, are the summary. They are the distilled quintessence of the insights of the entire Red Book. So that if we, once again, at a deep level, at a visionary level, at a transcendental level, apprehend the nature of the seven sermons, then we have apprehended, I think, the Red Book itself. And we shall continue with our at least attempted apprehensions next time. Thank you very much.
Copyright MMF, I didn't see recordings. Catalog. catalog number 200510. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.